Well, I've mentioned several times lately that when Jesus Christ was born, the Jews were expecting a Messiah at that moment in time. You know, the wise men came. They knew to be looking for a star, and they found it and they came. Have you ever wondered how they knew that? And if they knew it, is it possible for us to know it as well? I'm glad you asked, because, you know, not only is it a fascinating story, not only does it pertain to this Holy Day season, but it serves as irrefutable proof of the existence of God. Now, we're going to go through all of that today, and we're going to be messing around with time and math and history. Hopefully I can put it all together in a way that you're going to find interesting and hopefully inspiring as well. You see all of these things that happen, and you don't even think about it, but it's there. People often want God to prove himself. You know, and to non-believers, that's a big thing. You know, it's often said mockingly. You know, you can't see, you can't hear, you can't touch, can't taste God. Therefore, he cannot exist. That's the argument. And even for believers, there is that faith. You know, there's still that sense, though. Yes, I do believe in God, but it would not be nice if I just knew for sure. Is there something that I can hang on to? If we could only see or experience some miracle, some mighty act, then that would for sure be cemented into our minds. Some generations of humanity have witnessed mighty acts from God, have witnessed miracles. You think about this time of year, the children of Israel. They were that definition of living through God's miracles. And, you know, there may have been up to, they estimate, 2 million people or so. But even then, compared to the world's population, it was still a small group of people that actually witnessed that firsthand. And then you have new generations that come on. And as time passes, you have that memory of that diminishes. And it becomes a myth or a fable or a legend. And then this new generation is left wondering again why God doesn't prove himself to them. Now, what if one of those mighty acts was indelibly written upon human history? Wouldn't that be a great way to prove it for all time, for all people? If there was that one example we could all go back to, it would be helpful, wouldn't it? But where is that mighty act that's embedded in human history? We're going to go through all of that today. I want to begin, though, with a prophecy that Jesus made at his own death. I'm going to go around and we're going to get several different parts and pieces, and then finally we'll go and we'll put them all together. Let's begin in Matthew 12. Matthew 12, verses 38 through 40. Matthew 12. And beginning in verse 38, and some of the scribes and the Pharisees, they answered, saying, Teacher, talking to Christ, we want to see a sign from you. But he answered, and he said to them, An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. No sign will be given except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. So we're seeing this example. The scribes and Pharisees, they come to Christ. They want to see that sign. They want to see it. You know, some mighty act, some indisputable miracle to be shown to them to verify that, yes, Jesus was for real in their minds. But we see here Christ didn't give them this flashy display of power. He could have resurrected some people, or he could have done something miraculous, caused a great earthquake, or something else, you know, that was big and impressive. Instead, what did he say? I'm going to be like Jonah. I'm going to be 3 days and three nights, three daytime portions, three nighttime portions in the grave. And from their point of view, that had to have been quite a letdown, wouldn't it? You know, that sign probably meant very little to them. You know, they're probably asking amongst them, what's he talking about? What does that mean? But for future generations, and that would include us, this 3 days and three nights provide a time stamp for when his death, when his resurrection occurred in human history. And it could be verified by the most reliable source of timekeeping in the physical world. That is through the sun, the moon, and the stars. Let's go to Genesis. Genesis 1 and verse 14. The very creation account here. Genesis 1 and verse 14. Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. And he doesn't say it as such, but in effect, God created time. Notice here that in addition to creating the years, you know, so you know exactly how old you were, he did it also for what we're shown here he calls seasons. Seasons, it's that word moed. That word means an appointment or a festival. In other words, God created time so that we'd know when to keep his holy days. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. Now we know that the earth spins on its axis. One complete revolution is a day. We know the moon circles the earth. Complete revelation or revolution of that makes a month. The spinning earth circles around the sun. One time around is a year. So that means that there are certain alignments of all three of these objects that only happen at certain times. For example, a full moon, or a new moon, or an eclipse. Now, another important factor is that these alignments are visible to the human eye. In other words, everybody can see them. Now, as we've read here in Genesis, one of the reasons that God created time was so that we could properly observe his holy days. The dates for the annual holy days are set using a method based on the alignment of the earth, the moon, and the sun. That's why they don't always occur on the same date as we have with our calendar, but instead they shift around. And that's according to the alignment of the rotation of the moon around the earth and the earth around the sun. Let's go now to Leviticus, where it lists all the different feasts. Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, verses 1 and 2. It's an interesting statement when you look at it. But Leviticus 23, verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feast of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. Guess what the word is for feasts here? Moed. It's the very same word that we saw in Genesis when he said seasons. God now calls them feasts. So God is tying his feast, he's tying his seasons to time. And it was the duty of the priest in ancient Israel to proclaim the feast day, to make it known when those days would be. And the priest knew these things. They had a set of rules that they could follow. It was based on simple observations of the earth, the moon, and the sun. They had to do some adding and subtracting at times, but it was pretty basic stuff. Now, in addition, we know how the earth, the moon, and the sun interact. It's possible to determine, then, based on that, when the holy days are going to be well into the future. You know, I know I carry around a card that, you know, for the next 5-6 years, it lists when the holy days are. But in addition to that, we can also tell when they occurred in the past, based on the movement of the sun, the moon, and the earth. Now, when I mentioned about how the days were calculated, I mentioned about how months are calculated, I mentioned about how years were calculated, did you notice we missed one? We missed the week. Now, those others, they're all based on the movement of the earth, the moon, the sun, but not the weeks, are they? The calculation of a week, which is then used to determine the Sabbath, is not tied to the movement of any of these celestial bodies. It's merely a straightforward counting off 7 days, and then 7 more days, and then 7 more days. So we see that the weekly Sabbath is on a different and separate cycle than the holy days. Sometimes the weekly, the seventh-day Sabbath, actually coincides with one of the annual holy days, called annual Sabbaths. Now, the orbit of our planet around the sun and the moon around the earth are very precise. And we can use mathematics to predict where the objects will be in relation to one another literally at any point in time. That's how we know where they're going to be in the future. There's going to be a future full moon, or there's going to be an eclipse. Now, technically, it's predictive because it hasn't happened yet. But it's also highly accurate and highly precise. So in like manner, we're able to calculate backward. And we can know where the sun, the moon, the earth were in relation to one another on any given date in the past. So if you have the correct program, or perhaps you know someone who knows the correct program, you should be able to tell the date that the Passover occurred and say 1963, the year I was born, or 1492 when Columbus discovered the New World, or 512 BC, any date in the past, pick a date. There are programs out there that will tell you these things. Now, before we begin the process now of putting these different parts and pieces together, we need to clear up one major misconception regarding Jesus Christ. He said he would be 3 days and 3 nights. That major misconception is, when did Jesus Christ die? That would be handy to know. Now, Christianity will tell you that he died on a Friday afternoon, and that he rose again on Sunday morning. It's that Good Friday, Easter Sunday thing. Now, it doesn't take a math whiz to quickly understand that one cannot obtain 3 days and 3 nights between Friday afternoon and Sunday morning. And there are all kinds of creative explanations of how these two incompatible facts can make sense. But the bottom line is, it simply cannot be done. You cannot squeeze 3 days and 3 nights between Friday afternoon and Sunday morning. Let's go to the book of Luke. Luke 23. I'd like to begin reading in verse 53. Luke 23 and verse 53. And then go into the first part of chapter 24. So Luke 23, this was, after Jesus Christ had died. And verse 52 says, the man went to Pilate and he asked for the body of Jesus. So permission was given. Verse 53, he took it down, Jesus Christ's body, wrapped it in linen, laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of the rock where no one had ever lain before. The day was a preparation, and the Sabbath drew near. And the women who had come to him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. And they returned, and they prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. Continuing on, chapter 24. Now, on the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they and certain other women with them came to the tomb bringing the spices which they had prepared. But they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. They went in and did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. Now, so that's the story, kind of in a nutshell. This is Luke's account of it. Now, Christianity gets lost because they see the word Sabbath. And they know very little about what the Jews believe, but they do know that the Jewish Sabbath was Saturday. And it says here that Jesus had to be buried before the Sabbath. Therefore, he had to have died on a Friday. That's the assumption. So using that as a hard point, they see here is in chapter 24, verse 1, where it says the women, they came on the first day of the week. Now, they're right in meaning that was Sunday. We don't disagree with that. So that's how they obtained their ending point, Friday afternoon, Sunday morning. Now, justifying these two endpoints is where they have to get creative. And they do. It's interesting. Go to YouTube. There's all kinds of different explanations out there. Now, what they almost all universally misunderstand is that there were two Sabbaths involved here. There was an annual Sabbath, and there was a weekly Sabbath. It's amazing how people can't figure that out. Jesus had to be buried not before the weekly Sabbath, not before Saturday, but before the annual Sabbath, which was the first day of unleavened bread. Let's read again verse 56 of Luke 23. They returned and prepared spices and fragrant oil, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. Now, the women would not have bought and prepared spices on the annual Sabbath, on the first day of unleavened bread. So it had to have happened the day after the annual Sabbath. Again, though, they had to rest, it says, according to the Sabbath commandment, which was the fourth commandment. Now, that Sabbath was Saturday. The first day of the week, as we talked about it in chapter 24, verse 1, we're in agreement with, that was Sunday. So, for Jesus' death to have occurred on the daylight portion of Passover, for him to be in the tomb for three full periods of daylight and three full periods of nighttime, then for people to come to his tomb to find him long gone before daybreak, on the first day of the week, you put all those parts and pieces. The only way that could have happened, the Passover would have to fall on a particular relationship to the first day of unleavened bread and the weekly Sabbath. That day was a Wednesday. It was a Wednesday when he died. So, I've given you a lot of information here. So, let's recap a bit and then see what we can do to begin putting all the parts and pieces together. See if we can't get kind of a complete picture here. Hopefully I haven't lost you. So Christ died on a Wednesday afternoon. He would have been in the tomb three complete days, three complete nights. And God's creation of time allowed us to know when the holy days occurred. They allow us now. They allow us to know in the future and in the past. A lot of stuff to go through, and you know, we still haven't tied that to any proof of God's existence. And so let's forge ahead here. So using that high precision clock in the sky, the earth, the moon, the sun, and then calculating backward, the recorded events of Jesus' death could only have occurred in 31 AD. Now, there are other times when the Passover and the days of unleavened bread and the Sabbath all occur in that exact sequence. You know, a Tuesday evening Passover, a Thursday day of unleavened bread and a Saturday Sabbath. Think about it. This year falls that exact same cycle. So when we go through it this year, think this would have been the exact cycle that Christ would have been through. However, based on other verifiable historical information, for example, we can look at the dates of the governorship of Pilate, the death of Herod, and a census that occurred at the time of Augustus Caesar. You begin applying all these other historical events. And when you do that, 31 AD is the only year that fits all these general constraints. So the earth, the moon, the sun, they're all signs. The cycle of seven annual holy day Sabbaths are signs. The weekly Sabbath is a sign. 3 days and three nights that Christ gave are signs. And so these signs allow us then to pinpoint the date of Jesus' death. But, you know, knowing his exact date of death would only, you know, end up on a trivia show like Jeopardy or something like that as one of these nice-to-know things. Knowing that, right? Except for one little point. And that is this. God gave us that date in Scripture roughly 500 years earlier. He told us beforehand when it was going to happen. So let's go through it and tie this all together. Remember how we talked about it? You know, it sure would be great if God could and would somehow prove himself to us. In order to predict the death of Jesus Christ with exact accuracy, God would have to do something, wouldn't he? To spout it out some 500 years earlier and then it actually happened that way requires something to happen. It just doesn't accidentally do that. It would have to be something that humans cannot do beyond the physical laws that we have. And yet it had to be something that could not be dismissed as delusion or psychosis or just even creative math. Had to be something beyond that. So what was it that God would do? How would he achieve this? First thing he would do, he would tell us about it way in advance. It was roughly 500 years in advance. See, that's too far in advance for any one person or even a group of people to orchestrate, to make it all happen. That's a long time. The second thing he would have done, he would have put that prediction in such a way that there would be no argument that his prediction came hundreds of years before the actual event. You know, a lot of times people say, oh, you know, they actually did it after the fact, and therefore there was no prediction to begin with. So he has to take that element out of it. The third thing he would have to do, he would tie that prediction back to mankind's own written historical records, humanity's own devised methods of timekeeping and calendar dates. And he did. He used our own recorded history and timekeeping so that we could never go back and say, oh, God did this. He did a, you know, sleight of hand, played a trick on us. So he took that out of the equation. And God did just that. He told us way in advance. He made it in such a way that there's no argument that the prediction came well before the actual event. He did it in such a way that he could tie it back to humanity's own recorded history. Now, in very simplified terms, the predicted event, the death of the Messiah that we're talking about, would happen 486 and one half years after a public proclamation coming from one of the most famous kings in all of ancient history. It's a pretty bold statement, isn't it? Pretty exact. 486 and a half years. So how do we arrive at that? Let's put on your math hats here. We're about to dive into the deep end of the pool. Hopefully I haven't lost you. Now the specific prediction that we're referencing is found in a prophecy in Daniel 9. So let's go there. We're going to spend some time here. Daniel 9, verses 24 through 26. So let's read through that. Daniel 9, verse 24 through 26. It says, 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks. And 62 weeks, the street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. And after 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. It's pretty cryptic, isn't it? Let's see if we can make some sense out of it. Notice here, absolutely no one disputes that the book of Daniel was written long before the birth, the death, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Nobody disputes that. There's a lot of numbers here, so it's helpful to understand exactly what they mean, and then we can go forward from there. Now, my Bible says 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So other translations will say seven sevens and 62 sevens. The Good News Bible, for example, says it this way, 7 times 7 and 62 times 7. Everyone is pretty much in agreement here that weeks means 7 and that we're multiplying. There are several different parts to this prophecy that we need to examine. First, what are 70 weeks? Go back up to verse 1 and 2 of this chapter, chapter 9. It says, the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, and of the lineage of the Medes, who was made king over them in the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the numbers of years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. He's talking here about years, not days. And that's actually a biblical principle. You can write down Numbers 14, verse 34. And it tells you there that the children of Israel would wander in the desert for 40 years, a year for every day that the spies had scouted out Canaan. It says something similar in Ezekiel 4 and verse 6. It's a day for a year, and it's a biblical principle. So we can apply that, and we see that we're not talking about 490 days, but rather 490 years. Now, Daniel 9, verse 25. Let's go back to verse 25 again. It says, know therefore and understand that going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, the wall, even in troublesome times. So we're given two sets of numbers here, aren't we? 7 weeks, 62 weeks. And so using this principle of a day for a year, we're going to get 7 times 7 plus 62 times 7 comes up to 483. So it's 483 years. And that's to happen after a decree that goes out to rebuild Jerusalem. And it says after that, then the Messiah would appear on the scene. Now, let's exchange our math hats for a history lesson. Have I lost you yet? Hopefully you're still with me. Now, Jerusalem had been destroyed by the Babylonians when they invaded in 587 BC. That's a hard date, historical date. We know that. Now, the Babylonian Empire was then conquered, also during the lifetime of Daniel, by the Medo-Persian Empire. And the date for that, we know, is 538 B.C. So we know that. Hold your place here in Daniel. Let's go then to the book of Ezra. The book of Ezra. Comes after the Kings and the Chronicles and all that kind of stuff. Right before Nehemiah. Book of Ezra. Ezra 1, verses 1 and 2. Ezra 1, and beginning in verse 1, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing, saying, Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth, the Lord God of heaven has given me. He has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah." So we see this king here, by the name of Cyrus, he issues a decree to begin rebuilding the temple. Now, this decree represents the ending of the 70 years of captivity for when the Jews were in Babylon. God had decreed that there would be the 70 years. This decree from Cyrus ends that. And so permission is granted then to go back and to rebuild Jerusalem. But you see that it did not happen right away. There were a few Jews that did go back. And when they did, they struggled mightily against these hostile enemies that were all around them. Jerusalem, the walls were broken down. There was no way to defend it. And the enemies around them didn't want them there. And so the people that did go back, they got distracted, they got discouraged. And the rebuilding program came to a grinding halt before it even really began. Let's go to chapter 6 and verse 8 now. Ezra 6 and verse 8. And verse 8 says, "Moreover, I issue a decree as to what you shall do for the elders of these Jews, for the building of this house of God. Let the cost be paid at the king's expense from the taxes on the region beyond the river. This is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered." This is another decree. You can go back to verse 1. King Darius issues this decree. So we have another king. We have another decree. This decree is to resume building what had been started by Cyrus and had faltered, had stopped. Now, what's interesting, it is neither of these decrees, neither of these proclamations is the one that is tied then to Daniel's prophecy. We see another decree. Ezra 7, verses 7 through 9. Let's catch the author of this one. Verse 1, "After these things in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia." So we have another king. Verse 7, "Some of the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, the Nephilim, came up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. And Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king. And on the first day of the seventh month, he began his journey from Babylon. On the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem according to the good hand of his God upon him." So we're talking about Artaxerxes now. Now we have historical records that tell us exactly when Artaxerxes ruled. The seventh year of Artaxerxes would have taken place in 457 B.C., this is a historical fact, 457 B.C. Verse 11, let's notice verse 11. It says, "This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave Ezra the priest, the scribe, expert in the words of the commandments of the Lord and of his statutes to Israel." I'm not going to go through it, but what follows is a copy of the actual decree. that Artaxerxes wrote that allowed all the Jews that were willing to return to Jerusalem to restore it as a city. So this is a decree we're talking about. The important date to remember here is 457 B.C. That's the year the proclamation that's referenced in Daniel's prophecy. Still with me? Okay, let's go back to Daniel. Daniel 9, again, Daniel 9, verse 25. It says, "Know therefore and understand from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublesome times." So, our 70-week prophecy is broken into three parts. We have 7 weeks and then 62 weeks. If you add that together, it's only 69. So there has to be another week. So what's the significance then of each one of these segments? Let's begin with the 7 weeks. Again, using the day for a week principle, take the 7 weeks, 7 times 7, 49, would be 49 years. You come to 408 B.C. when you begin at 457 B.C., now, 408 B.C. is when Jerusalem and the wall were finished. That was in spite of hardship, of trials, attack from their enemy. At that point in time, the 7 weeks had been fulfilled. Now, you have the remaining 62 weeks. You multiply that out, 434, or it's 434 years. So that's the time between the reinstatement of Jerusalem and the beginning of the ministry of the Messiah. So you can take the year 457 B.C., you then use that as a starting point for the prophecy we see here in Daniel 9. And you add it all up 483 years later. You have to make sure that there is no year zero, so you have to take that into account. But when you do that, it takes you to the year 27 A.D., 27 A.D. Toward the end of that year in 27 A.D., Jesus Christ is baptized and begins his ministry. The Messiah has now appeared on the scene right on schedule. Now the Jews, they weren't ignorant of this prophecy. They also knew how to add and subtract. They knew the math that was required to find the date of the coming Messiah. See, that's one of the reasons they were expecting a Messiah at the time that Jesus Christ came. Now, let's continue on. Verse 26 and 27 here in Daniel 9. Verse 26, "After the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined." Verse 27, "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week." So here's our 70th week. "But in the middle of the week, he shall be brought to an end. He shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be the one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate." Again, a lot, and I'm not going to hit on everything here. But we see here one more week. Remember, the 7 and the 62 is 69. So here's our final week. So according to this, sometime after the 69 weeks, or 483 years, the Messiah will be put to death. So he's going to be put to death sometime during this 70th week. And actually, it's more than just during. It says in the middle of the week. So what's the middle of 7? It's 3.5. So Christ's ministry began sometime closer to the end of 27 A.D., at the end of 69 sevens, the conclusion of 483 years. And so I would have to estimate that his baptism was probably sometime around the fall holy days. And we know from when he was baptized, he then taught and preached for 3.5 years. So if he began sometime right around the fall holy days of 27 A.D., then the fall holy days in 28 A.D. would have been the first year. The fall holy days of 29 A.D. would be the second year. The fall holy days of 30 A.D. would be the third year. So now you've got 3 years. You're at the fall holy days, 30 A.D. But it's 3.5 years. Add 6 months to that. Takes us up to the Passover of 31 A.D. So Christ died in the middle of that final week, that 70th week, as was prophesied that we saw here in verse 27. 486.5 years from the decree that went forth from Artaxerxes to restore the Jewish people back to Jerusalem. Now there's a couple of important aspects that we also see here in verse 27. I want you to notice here it says Christ would confirm a covenant for many. Now this phrase, confirm a covenant, is rendered in the American Standard Version as make a firm covenant. And in the English Standard Version, it says it this way, make a strong covenant. Now, the Hebrew word here translated confirm means to make firm, means to be strong, to prevail, to bind up anything broken, to make firm or to strengthen. And so when he says to confirm a covenant, he means to further establish, to further strengthen a covenant that already exists. The covenant that is made firm or made strong is the new covenant, which is a binding, a strengthening of God's law. Remember, we can go back through Matthew chapters 5 through 7, Sermon on the Mount. Christ spent a lot of time magnifying the law of God. Jesus emphasized this new or strengthened or firm covenant for 3.5 years and then was crucified. Another interesting aspect here in verse 27 is that he would do away with animal sacrifices. After Christ died, the Levitical sacrifices were no longer necessary. That's because they had all along been this representation of his atoning sacrifice for sin. And now he came and he did it. And so that means that he brought an end, as it says, to sacrifice an offering. Now the Jews continued on at the temple to offer sacrifices until the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. But even though they continued on at this time, the death of Jesus Christ, they were no longer required. And you can read through the book of Hebrews. That's one of the reasons, one of the themes that you see in Hebrews, was to convince the Jews that because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, because of the introduction of the new covenant, the sacrificial system was no longer necessary. So the prophetic seventh week, that 7-year period of time, began with Jesus Christ's ministry. As we know, he was cut off. He was crucified halfway through, 3.5 years into it, the middle of the week. It's interesting, not only did he die in the middle of the prophetic week, but we've already seen he died on a Wednesday. He died in the middle of the calendar week as well. Now, Jesus' death, the full sequence of 3 days and 3 nights in the tomb, that time stamp, the date of his death in alignment to the earth, the moon, and the sun. And we know that's an event that could have only happened the Passover of 31 AD. It's indelibly written in that time clock of the universe. So Jesus died on a Wednesday afternoon, late in the afternoon, at about 3 o'clock. And so he was then quickly put into the tomb before the beginning of the first day of unleavened bread, that annual Sabbath that began at sundown. And so you had the first night. It's pretty obvious he would have been in the tomb that first night after his death. So that was the nighttime portion of the first day of unleavened bread. Then you have the first day. That would have been the daylight portion of the first day of unleavened bread. And then you had the nighttime portion of Friday, which as we would look at it would be a Thursday evening. And then for the second day, you would have the daylight portion of Friday. And so it's during this daylight portion of Friday that the women bought and prepared spices in order to, you know, to rub on the corpse. So this was the day after the first day of unleavened bread, which was an annual Sabbath, and it was the day before the weekly Sabbath on a Saturday. So that's the second day, the third night. So the nighttime period of the Sabbath, it would have been a Friday night. And then you have the third day. So that's the daylight portion of Saturday, of the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath. So as it was the weekly Sabbath, again, the women would have refrained from the work of preparing the spices for the corpse. So the 3 days and three nights are complete after the daylight portion of Saturday. So after the sign of 3 days and three nights was completed, at the completion of the daylight portion of Saturday, Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. As we saw in Luke, it said that the women came while it was still dark. In other words, it was before dawn. Jesus Christ was already gone because he'd already been resurrected. Now, in the interest of being thorough, there were actually three different phrases that are used to describe the time that Jesus Christ spent in the tomb. And so we should consider those. They are similar, but they're different enough that we have to take this into consideration. Let's go to Matthew 27. Matthew 27 and verse 63. And so this is from the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they're before Pilate, and they said, saying, "Sir, we remember while he was still alive," talking about Christ, "how the deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise.'" So now we see a phrase, "after 3 days." Let's go a chapter before that, chapter 26, verse 61. Verse 61, chapter 26 says, "And said, this fellow," talking again about Christ, "said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" So now we see "in 3 days." Now Mark's account in Mark 14 says "within 3 days." So now we have "after 3 days" and "within 3 days." Let's go now to Matthew 16, verse 21. Matthew 16, verse 21. It says, "From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day." So now you have "after 3 days," you have "within 3 days," and "the third day." Is that a contradiction? If it was just under 3 days or just over 3 days, would it really matter? We're never told. We're never given that answer. But when you look at it, if you think about it, if you consider it, if Christ were raised at exactly 72 hours after he was placed in the tomb, it would have satisfied all three statements. You would have to think it would be at that exact instant. Would have been after 3 days. Would have been within 3 days. It would have been the third day. Is that possible? Is that how it happened? We have a God who's very exact in everything. It's entirely possible. So these events could only have occurred as recorded if Jesus had died in 31 A.D. And when he did die in 31 A.D., he died on the exact date that God said he would, some 500 years previously, as predicted in the Scripture, as testified by the earth, the moon, and the sun, as written in the very history of the Persian kings. Now, the church spends a lot of time proving and teaching 3 days and three nights. We're also very particular about the timing and how we keep the holy days. We preserve the observance of the weekly Sabbath. Why do we do these things? There's a good reason why the church spends an awful lot of time talking about these things. Is it to show off? Is it to show everybody else that we're somehow more biblically literate and that we can then think ourselves better than anyone else? No, it's because all of these things are signs. Your ongoing observance of the weekly Sabbath, your observance of the annual Sabbaths, our teaching of 3 days and three nights in the tomb, the research into historical documents, archaeology, we are participating in the very proof and the validity, the validation that God is providing to all of humanity so that we are without excuse. For our last scripture, let's go to Romans 1. Romans 1, verses 18 through 20. Romans 1. Verses 18 through 20. I'm actually going to read this from the Good News Bible. I like the way that translation puts this. You can follow along in your Bible. Romans 1, beginning in verse 18. God's anger is revealed from heaven against all the sin and evil of the people whose evil ways prevent the truth from being known. God punishes them because what can be known about God is plain to them, for God himself made it plain. Ever since God created the world, his invisible qualities, both his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly seen. They are perceived in the things that God has made. So those people have no excuse at all. Now, we often think about and talk about this passage through the lens of, you know, the creation that goes on around us. And that is a very valid way to view this passage, but let's dive a little deeper. When we do, we understand it encompasses things like the prophecy in Daniel 9 about how God provided the proof of Christ's coming in advance. People want God to prove himself. For those with ears to hear, let them hear.